The National Broadcasting Company presents Lives of Great Men, a series on great leaders in human progress, presented by Dr. Edward Howard Griggs, distinguished lecturer, critic, and author of Soul of Democracy and many other books. In this talk, conversation based on outstanding characters through the ages and how each one influences his own and future times. This evening, Dr. Griggs will discuss Pierre Loti, the sensitive dreamer as child and man. We present Edward Howard Griggs.
My friend, Loti is the name of a flower in the South Sea Islands. It was given Louis Marie Julien Viau by the women of Tahiti and adopted by him as his pen name. In that fact alone, his whole spirit is revealed. His love of the exotic and primitive, his longing for somewhere else, for all that is untouched by rampant material civilization. All of Loti's books, written in exquisite French prose, are veiled or unveiled records of his own experience, his response to nature in his wide wandering, the episodes of his love life, his reflections of poignant sadness over the transiency of it all. At 40, Loti wrote of the first 14 years of his life in The Story of a Child, dedicating it to the beloved and gifted Carmen Sylva, Queen of Romania. His dreamy and delicate prose style had completely matured, and his book of early memories is one of the most precious autobiographies of childhood ever written. In showing the child as father of the man, it is also deeply instructive for education. In groping to recall his childhood memories, his interest is wholly that of the artist, seeking to give permanence to transient moods and quick-passing scenes in the drama of life. Loti was of earnest and cultivated Huguenot ancestry. In the reign of the Grand Monarch, certain of his forebears had fled to Holland from the island of Oleron, where they were the leading family, on the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. He was born in 1850 at Rochefort, near the coast of France, south of Brittany. His boyhood was spent there, with excursions to Limoges and long annual visits to the island of Oleron, where a portion of the family still dwelt. His home environment was all of older persons, chiefly women. His idolized mother and older sister, a grandmother, several aunts and a great aunt, all living in the one large house and all lovingly catering to the one sensitive little boy. His nature thus flowered under warm affection, but there was no discipline to give self-direction and control. In the early years, he was given almost no formal education. There was some study under tutors, the boy hurriedly preparing his lessons at the last minute, and a brief period in a day school. On the other hand, all influences stimulated his emotional and imaginative development. His first companions were mainly little girls. He was given lessons in piano playing and became expert in that art. It is significant that he was especially fond of Chopin, since Loti's prose has the same romantic quality, the moving minor chords, the tender mood of sadness and longing, marking the music of Chopin. The nature world about the child was one of rich vegetation and varied beauty, with great oak forests, and he early wakened a passionate love for it. He collected shells, fossils, butterflies, and soon had an extensive museum, adding to it the strange Chinese ornaments and South Sea treasures sent by his elder brother stationed in the East. His brother's letters and gifts, a widely traveled uncle's reminiscences, old logbooks from ancestral seafarers, and a pictured volume of Oceanica, together brought to consciousness his instinctive longing for somewhere else. His earliest thought of vocation, highly pleasing to his family, had been to become a minister of religion, but this quickly turned to the idea of foreign missionary, since that calling would take him to faraway lands. This wakened longing is expressed in the narration of his first sight of the ocean, in a passage characteristic of the mood of his Story of a Child. I will now endeavor to explain the impression that the sea made upon me at our first brief and melancholy encounter, which took place at twilight upon the evening of my arrival on the island. As night was falling, I went alone to seek this mysterious thing. The air was sharp and biting, and from behind the hillocks of sand there came a faint but majestic noise. Suddenly I stopped, overcome and almost paralyzed by fear. For something took shape before me, something dark and surging sprang up from all sides at the same time, and it seemed to stretch out endlessly. It was the sea of my imagining. Without a moment's hesitation, I recognized it and I trembled with a great emotion. At our first encounter, I'm sure I had a nebulous presentiment that I would one day go to it in spite of my hesitation, in spite of all the efforts put forth to hold me back, and I seemed to feel the anguish of desolation, bereavement, and exile. In contrast to the longing for the far away, there was in Loti a deep attachment to persons, things, and places, with a hunger for their permanence. He felt to the extreme the grief over the transiency of human lives, in contrast to the persistence of inanimate objects. The Huguenot household had strongly that feeling of family solidarity, characteristic of the more earnest French, and Loti fully shared it. He was passionately and with permanent loyalty attached to persons in his family connection. Had he shown the same fidelity in sex love as in the family relation, the veil of sadness need not have shadowed everything for him, nor would he have chanted the ceaseless requiem over the nothingness of life. After the age of 60, he followed the story of his childhood with that of his youth, and his son later published bits from partially destroyed diaries, carrying the narration through the period of early manhood. Loti tells frankly of his initiation to the life he was to lead through a Juno-esque gypsy girl, first of the numerous episodes which were to enthrall and bereave his life. In describing the forest scene of it, he makes the comment so significant of his memories: "The places where we have neither loved nor suffered leave no trace in our remembrance." Having early drifted away from the family religion, the boy turned from the idea of becoming a missionary to the dream of a sailor's life, which he hoped to realize as naval officer. This his family strongly opposed. Only when the disaster of poverty descended upon the household did they yield from necessity. It is interesting that the finest French stylist of his time was poor while at school in French composition. Had his teachers only been wise enough to let him write of what absorbingly interested him, that is the lesson for education. In the Latin Quarter of Paris, he studied hard to complete his preparation for the government examinations, fearing rejection and so defeat of his dream of life at sea. He disliked Paris extremely, its garish modernity, material grandeur, and noisy crowds. Among the cadets accepted, he took ship at Brest on the Borda for his training at sea. The published fragments of his incessantly written diaries, or rather books of tender and sad meditation on what he saw and experienced, show how emotionally he responded to the faraway lands visited. The colonies in Africa, Constantinople and the Near East, India, the South Sea Islands, all were lands where the human life was exotic and primitive, unspoiled for Loti by material civilization, as were the mysterious tropical forests and vegetation. The diary of a period when Loti was stationed at Constantinople was shown to a brother officer. He changed some names and other details to prevent the revelation being too personal and offered the volume to a Paris publisher. It was accepted and issued as Azayade, launching Loti at 26 on his career as novelist. It is a tender story of a beautiful Turkish harem girl, but it was essentially Loti's personal experience, is evidenced by his published letters, revealing the frantic efforts he made to have Azayade aided to escape to France. His full intention was to marry her in spite of all difficulties, but Turkey was at war and Azayade disappeared. That his love life was of episodes was thus caused partly by the fate of his wandering life. At 30, he produced Rarahu, the story of a naval officer stationed at Tahiti, who finds in a lovely child of nature the incarnation of all the exotic charm of the bizarre tropical world. He establishes his life with her, and later comes the call of the centuries of culture in his blood and inheritance, but not in hers, and he goes away. Tragedy for both. Yet one wonders whether, even with the abyss between, it was inevitable. Loti republished Rarahu under the title The Marriage of Loti, which would seem to indicate a personal background for the story. Madame Chrysanthemum is an episode in Japan, showing Loti's love for the old picturesque culture with dislike for the new Japan, ambitiously copying Western material civilization. The spirit of India without the English is sufficiently indicated in the book's title, while Disenchanted portrays the anomalous situation of the partially freed harem women of Turkey. Loti was peculiarly tenacious in friendship particularly with simple, unsophisticated men. My Brother Eve is a story based on such a companionship with a common sailor to whom he was devotedly attached. Lottie's career as naval officer contains one heroic chapter. He was in active service in the Tonkin War, and at Hue was incensed at atrocities committed by the French troops. He wrote letters to the Paris Figaro exposing and protesting these acts. That, of course, was transgressing the restrictions on an officer in any government service, and with the emotional French, invited the fate of a Drasus. Lottie was punished by a year's suspension from service, but was then allowed to resume. At 37, he received the Cross of the Legion of Honor, and at 41 was elected to the French Academy in competition with Zola, whose realism he detested. After becoming captain in the Navy, he was retired from active service at 60. Lottie's finest novel is The Iceland Fisherman, produced at 36. It portrays movingly the hard Breton fisher life, where the villages are inhabited during the long fishing season only by women, children, and the helpless aged, the men being away in the waters of Iceland and Newfoundland, battling the treacherous seas. It describes the joyous festival of their return, but not all return, and the little graveyards have numerous crosses and slabs to the memory of those lost at sea. The story has a glorious heroine in the deep-loving, loyal Go, Breton for Margaret, and a splendid young hero in the dreamer Jan, already wedded to the sea. This time, Lottie was portraying pure love and not a poignant episode of the senses. We made a literary pilgrimage to Sampol and other scenes of the story, to the chapels and graveyards with their tragedy-telling crosses, only to realize that, as in all his books, Lottie was lending himself out to echo the life he observed or lived. The novel is so fine because the love it portrays was so true and loyal, rising to the plane of the spirit. In both life and art, Lottie was thus responsive rather than creative. Like an Aeolian harp, he lent himself to the soft winds of beauty and desire, echoing them in exquisite prose. Then, when the wind was silent, came the anguished sadness. The rose of the senses gives color and perfume, but so soon is dust. Had there been one strong disciplinary influence over Lottie's childhood, perhaps the life story would have been different. Had there been one permanently absorbing love relationship, compelling loyalty, his history might not have been of episodes ending in sadness. When the World War broke, Lottie, though 64, offered himself for active service. He asked for the command of a ship, to which his rank entitled him, but his books on India and Turkey caused the Minister of Marine to refuse his request. Instead, he was given an important place in the Intelligence Department. He wrote numerous articles on war episodes and atrocities, gathered up in two volumes. At the war's close, he received the citation, "Although freed from military obligations by age, he resumed service at the beginning of the war, thus giving a fine example of devotion and patriotism. He fulfilled several missions under fire." Lottie suffered much from his early drift away from the earnest religion of his family. After one poignant episode of his life, he entered a Trappist monastery for a time and dreamed, though not for long, of finding peace in joining such a brotherhood. His sensitive spirit at every crisis hungered for communion with the eternal. One of his last volumes, A Pilgrim of Angkor, closes with an anguished appeal to the pity supreme. He died in his beloved Basque country, June 10th, 1923. Thus the Aeolian harp, that had vibrated to so many winds of beauty and desire, drew to silence with the solemn overtone of the soul.